Tonight on the Stephen Dan Podcast, Stephen Dan discuss episode 503 of The Walking Dead, Four Walls and a Roof. Hi, I'm Steve.
And I'm Dan, and we're going to talk about Walking Dead Season 5, Episode 3, Four Walls and a Roof.
That's right. This one is directed by Jeffrey F. January. Frank Darabont was the creator, Robert Kirkman, Tony Moore, Charlie Adlard for the comics, and for the actual episode, Angela Kang and Corey Reed.
And all of them did an amazing job. This was some good TV last night, man.
This is three hits in a row, man. We're doing really well here.
I gotta say, this is shaping up already. I know it's a bit bold to be making claims like this, but this seems to me to be the best season so far.
Yeah, you know, this is exactly, I gotta say, I felt exactly this way when episode 5 hit last season. There was that kind of gradual build-up with the illness and with people getting separated, and there were the deaths of Karen and the other fella when Carol took them out, and it built up to internment, which was episode 5, which is when, we talked about this last week, when Herschel did his kick-ass badassery and Carl and Rick were outside. But that took 5 episodes to get to that point. Here we're starting right off the bat, aren't we?
And all the action is plot-driven, you know? There's nothing extra, there's no killing time, there's no manufacturing of dangerous scenarios, a weird jeopardy for the characters to fall into. Everything seems to be happening for a reason.
Exactly. And the guy is, with the governor, which I love the governor, I must admit, I think he went a little bit long. You know, when we have 16 episodes, basically, of Woodbury, and then another, like, 8 in the next season, as good a bad guy as he was, he got overused.
He went way too long. It seemed as though it made sense because he was involved with Andrea, so it seemed to be important to her character, but she checks out anyway. So even that part of the storyline was expendable and pointless. Anyway, screw the governor.
Let's not
waste any more airtime on that eye-patched, boring freak. Let's talk about Gareth.
Oh, Gareth. I love Gareth. Interesting character. He's kind of, okay, where you've got the psychopath and the governor, you've got the bureaucrat from hell.
Oh, absolutely. I was kind of surprised to see Gareth die at the end of this episode. I thought that he had a couple of more episodes in him at least. But leaving us wanting more. This is something Walking Dead has not been doing the last few seasons. They've been squeezing every bit of tension, every bit of amusement out of all of the storylines. It's really good just to do something decisive, something that feels like it was timely and right, and leaves you genuinely wondering what's going to happen next.
No, I agree. I think that a lot of us expected a lot of us expected Gareth to be stretched out at least over the first half of this season. So I think it's gutsy for them to take him out in episode 3, because it leaves the question, where are we going from here? Mm. Obviously, with the group splitting up, Abraham heading off north and Rick waiting around for Daryl and Carol, it creates new tensions, because now you can have two storylines concurrently, which seemed to work fairly well for the latter half of last season. But there's no big bad. There's no big bad sitting out there at the moment.
No, there's not. There's a potential big bad in the... Well, we don't know what happened to Beth. We can only presume that it's something bad.
And well, there have been some preview videos, which we'll talk at the end of the episode about,
yeah,
which suggest where she might be at this point.
Okay, so tonight's episode, where do we start?
We start with a gratuitous close-up of grease-covered chins as they're chewing down on Bob.
Yeah, it seems like if you become a cannibal in the post-apocalypse, you also have to abandon all table manners.
Yeah, some napkins would have been handy, I think. Bob was pretty greasy, which surprises me because he looks pretty lean.
Yeah, and he didn't have that extra layer of fat that even skinny girls have.
Yeah, they mentioned that might be to do with the whole childbearing idea. A lot of the dialogue in the scene, by the way, was taken, again, directly from Kirkman's original words. This has been happening now for a couple of episodes. Even the end of episode 16 last season, the final line that Rick yells out, that was taken. So we have a lot of resonance for people who've read the comics, and Bob is sobbing at first, isn't he?
Yeah, he does this thing. It's a kind of quite a common cinematic trope when a character will appear to be either laughing and then turn out to be crying, or in this case, the opposite. A character seems to be crying. They think he's cracked up. The female character steps forward and says, well, I'm surprised it took him this long, to be honest.
And Martin offers to take him out right there because he's thinking, well, if he's crazy, we don't want to be listening to him anymore.
And then the actor, Gilliard Jr., I think his name is.
Yes, Lawrence Gilliard. Lawrence Gilliard Jr., yeah.
He does a really good job, you know. I mean, I felt kind of sad because Bob's been a bit of a bore for me. But today, I was genuinely sad to see him go. Like, I was almost tearing up at the end. But he does a really good turn right there. I think he says, I've been bitten, you prick. Or something like that.
I've been bitten. I'm tainted meat. And then he just starts to laugh. Tainted meat! Tainted meat!
And you get some,
I loved it.
Some pretty amusing vomiting scenes.
I mean, as gratuitous as the greasy chins and the chewing down seem to be, the vomit was great. Except for Gareth, who keeps his stomach. Yeah. What does he say?
He says, we cooked him. Everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, because apparently they cooked the virus out.
Yeah, internal temperature of 167.
That's right. I didn't see the meat thermometer, but I'm assuming he had it because he is a bureaucrat.
He's probably got an app.
They're not happy. But, you know, what do you do when you buy bad meat at the store?
You take it back.
And that's what they do. They take Bob back and they drop him off at the church.
Yeah, they resort to another common cinematic trope, which is the Trojan Bob. They return Bob, hoping that, I presume, they'll take him in and he'll turn.
Yeah, partially that, and also they're playing a psychological game with the rest of the group. They're trying to say, we don't care if you know where we are. And he thinks Rick's a hothead. So he figures that Rick's going to hear where they are and he's going to come straight out there to get them.
Yep, so Sasha's out wandering around with her newly silenced and scoped weapon. And she spies a hooded figure. And right when she's trying to figure out who it is, a zombie jumps up in front of her, takes it out in the face, and then nails the other one with the butt of the gun. And then she's joined by Tyrese and Rick.
Yeah, they come and they help her dispose of the two walkers. There's a few walkers around them. And Rick tells her that it's not just Bob that's missing. He tells her that Daryl and Carol are missing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got problems. They head back to the church. And who does she blame for all this?
Well, Gabriel. I mean, Gabriel's the only unknown here.
This is a very classic case of correlation versus causation. She's looking at this. We've met Father Gabriel, and now people are going missing. Therefore, it's Father Gabriel's fault.
It's quite a sensible conclusion to jump to be honest.
Oh, I agree. And especially in a situation like this where when there's a change, then it tends to correlate with all the other stuff that's happening around you. But she is forgetting that they've only just left Terminus. Like, Terminus is not that far behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So she's kind of not... She's not thinking very clearly, and who would in these situations or these circumstances. But this actually causes an interesting scene with Father Gabriel, probably his best scene of the night.
So they confront Father Gabriel and they ask him what's going on and they want to get the truth out of him. And we learn something that I think we kind of suspected, at least we discussed it in the last episode. His secret is that people came for sanctuary sometime after they'd bombed Atlanta. Because I believe they bombed Atlanta. It was kind of like a last-ditch attempt by the military when it was obvious the city was going to hell. His congregation come and try to get access to the church, but Father Gabriel's too scared. He's locked all the doors and he has to listen to the sound of families and people he knows, the old organ player I presume, being torn to pieces by zombies, although one of them somehow found the time to carefully etch "You will burn for this," presumably just before they were torn to pieces.
Yeah, there's a few problems with this. Like, he's still trying to justify the situation. He's saying that, I always lock the doors. And he said they came too early, so the doors weren't unlocked. Well, then unlock the goddamn doors. You know, like, it's not like he didn't have a choice in this situation. But he's still trying to justify it to Rick and the gang. The bigger issue I had with this is later on, when we see Gareth and Martin and the other cannibals arrive, they literally go up to the front door. Martin sticks like a crowbar in between the two front doors, and within 3 seconds has jimmied them open.
Yeah.
So why do the families not think to do this? If you know, I'm a dad, you're a dad. If your kid's in dire jeopardy, you're going in. You're going to make a way into that building.
Yeah, I've got a theory though. Gareth and his cronies gaining access to the church was part of Rick's plan. So it could well be that the church has more substantial locks that weren't engaged just to allow them to get in.
This is certainly a possibility. And with a suspension of disbelief and how excellent the episode was, otherwise I will give them that.
We've got to give it to them, yeah. There's at least one inconsistency that we're going to discuss later on, but otherwise, pretty solid, pretty plausible stuff tonight.
So Gabriel, he does pretty much physically the same thing he did in the basement of the food bank. He falls back into a position of supplication. You know how when two dogs meet and there's an overpowering alpha dog and there's a beta dog, the beta will roll over on its belly, on his back, and expose its belly?
Yeah.
That's basically what Father Gabriel does. He rolls over on his back and exposes his belly to Rick and says,
he starts,
you know,
crying, I don't deserve soils to live. His robes.
Quite sure there was a puddle of urine around him at that point.
Later on, just towards the end as well, when he's outside the church with Michonne and it appears as though danger is rearing its head. And I don't know if you noticed, but Gabriel just slinks straight back into the church.
He knows where he belongs.
Yeah, he's a bona fide coward. The character's kind of believable, at least internally consistent now. Quite often when you get a new character, they'll appear to be a certain way, but then there'll be a tell. You know, the show will give us clues as to their real nature. But Father Gabriel seems to be played pretty straight as the cowardly priest.
One of the really nice thing too is that it looks as though, along with the other non-combatant, Eugene, we might have Father Gabriel around for a while.
Hmm.
And he's played by a great actor in Seth Gilliam with lots of chops. You know, he's been around a long time. He's very good at what he does.
Can we assume that he's going to go with Rick now? Because it looks to me like it would take a lot of effort to prize him out of that church.
I don't think there's any reason for him to stay, though. I mean, all the food's been taken from the town. He'd have to go further afield to get food.
The group is going to be his new church, right? It's his new sanctuary.
But Sasha forgave him, too. Like, you've got that case where after they realize that, no, he's not behind the disappearances because Bob shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And he offers his couch inside of his office for Bob. Like, that's a real human moment between the two of them. And he's told, basically, by her, I believe it is later in the episode, that, you know, we've all made mistakes. Like, it's actually Michonne later just saying, like, yeah, we're not perfect. None of us are perfect. We've all been there. So, you know, they've done bad things to be where they are. She's talking about her boyfriend and his friend who didn't protect her son, Andre, back in the day,
mm-hmm.
and how she used them as kind of zombie shields or walker shields. And she's not going to tell him that, but that's what we know. And so that's in the back of her mind that she wasn't perfect either, and she made mistakes, and she treated people pretty badly.
Yeah, Michonne's definitely got a lot of baggage.
And we unpacked a lot of it last season, which was great, because now we really understand where she's coming from. I love the way they build her up. It took until the second half of the season to really get to know her, but in the first half of the season, she had that moment where she was holding Judith and she started to cry,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't obvious why. And the nice thing is they didn't rush that character exposition. They actually showed it to us later in, I think it was episode maybe 409, possibly it was, when, no, it wouldn't be 409 because she didn't come until the very end of that episode. So the next episode, which we had Carl and her going off and doing stuff while Rick was recuperating, and she tells him about Andre.
One thing about Michonne is that aside from her kind of relationship with Carl, she seemed like a little bit of a spare wheel. She doesn't really have a role to play in the show. And I'm hoping now that a few of the other more assertive characters have left, there's going to be a bit more room for us to see what Michonne has to offer this season.
Well, Michonne's got tons of potential. I mean, you've got a badass katana wielding warrior, right? And who could ask for more? She's the ninja of the show, or the samurai of the show. But she's never... Daryl would be the ninja, because he's the one that's hiding in the bushes all the time.
He's more like the squirrel.
Yeah, he's a noisy squirrel.
He keeps popping his head up at weird moments, like lurking down the bushes.
Well, it's true, but the thing about Daryl is, like, he's this awesome tracker and hunter, and we established him that way in the last four seasons, and now all of a sudden, every time he's in the bush, everybody hears him. You notice that?
Yeah.
Yeah, like in episode two, there were two or three occasions where people would hear him rustling through the bushes, and then he'd show up with his squirrels. And then last night, of course, at the very end of the episode, Michonne quite clearly hears him rustling through the bushes when he does appear to be trying to be quiet.
Yeah, the fact that we'll talk about this later, but Daryl might be accompanied by someone who might be making noise.
He's definitely accompanied by someone, mm-hmm. yeah. But
definitely by someone.
By someone.
Okay, so Father Gabriel has his little meltdown. That seems to somewhat satisfy Sasha and Rick.
And then they hear a whistle from outside.
Right.
And this confirms Father Gabriel's claim to not be responsible or involved, because who's outside but Bob? And they bring him in, and they get him, they bring him around, and he tells them basically what happened. And he does also reveal to them that Carol and Daryl have left.
Yeah, Carol tells them that they drove off.
That's right. So now we know that it was just Bob. They have fewer things to worry about. What's Abraham's reaction? Abraham is very interesting in this moment.
Well, Abraham's like, well, can't you guys see it's time to leave? This is getting kind of out of hand. We need to cut our losses and just go.
And that's not really strategically a very good choice. It's the dead of night. You know they're nearby because they've just dropped off Bob. And you're going to take Eugene, who is this valuable commodity, out into the open and into the bus.
Yeah, I mean, the way it's sold to us is that Abraham is foreseeing an imminent attack on the church. So Abraham's motivated to get Eugene out to safety. So you think that his decision's kind of rash?
Well, no, he's strategizing. He's thinking, how would I deal with a group holed up in a wooden building in the middle of a clearing?
Mm-hmm.
He'd probably burn it to the ground, right? Yeah. Now, he's not thinking like a cannibal. A cannibal doesn't want to roast all its meat at the same time, because then it's going to be starving 2 days later, right?
You make a good point.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I occasionally do. It's a very rare thing for me. He is thinking, okay, if I wanted to get these people out of this relatively fortified, you know, the windows are all blocked up and all that kind of thing, I would just set fire to it. And that would make sense. That's what I would do too, because they've got the advantage. They can see what's going on. They don't even have a window to look out of.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to get Eugene out of there. But at the same time, I don't think it's a good strategic move, because it's the middle of the night. They could be in the bushes with their guns. He knows they're well-armed. He knows that they're quiet. He knows that they've been watching. So it's Abraham being a bit of a hothead, I think.
So Abraham and Rick have this kind of standoff when Abraham's like, well, we're leaving. Rick's like, well, fine, go. And Abraham's like, we're going. And Rick's like, "We'll go, but you're not taking my bus."
Try and stop me.
And then Abraham's mad because he spent the last 3 days changing the spark plugs and, you know, filling up the
spark
oil,
plugs
checking,
are hard when you're using
checking
your
the
fingers.
Tire pressure.
Yeah, there's no more tools in the zombie apocalypse here, so he had to use his fingers to undo those spark plugs.
So he's justifiably indignant, in my opinion, and he decides he's taking the bus anyway. They square up, and then in steps Glenn. I mean, Tara steps in. That didn't really make much sense to me. Tara says, "I've got a solution. If you hang out for a bit, I'll go with you." Tara doesn't seem to be much of an asset, but I guess Abraham needs everyone that he can get.
Well, then he asks for Glenn and Maggie particularly, which is interesting, because he did work with them for a few episodes last season, so he knows that they're capable, right?
Yeah, I was wondering, what was the significance of that? I mean, he obviously knows Glenn. He's got a lot of respect for him. Abraham seems to have respect for anyone who stands up to him. But do you have a theory as to why he was particularly interested in bringing Glenn and Maggie, and why he was so presumptuous as to think that they would come?
Well, I think that he's seen Glenn in action particularly, right? He's seen how Glenn is a survivor. He got out of the prison, he saved Tara, he was knocked out when he first met him, but still he was capable and he actually went toe-to-toe with Abraham, and I think there's a respect there. Maggie comes with a package. It doesn't matter to him so much that Maggie comes, I don't think. I think what matters to him is that he wants Glenn.
Right.
And Glenn and Maggie come as a couple. Now that does draw a really interesting problem here, because what's one of the major reasons Rick wants to stick around?
Yeah, there's two reasons Rick wants to stick around. The first is to figure out the Daryl and Carol situation, but the second is Beth.
Yeah,
Beth is still missing, who
and
happens
her
also
sister?
To be Maggie's sister.
Yeah,
and Maggie doesn't even seem to pause to think about that.
She doesn't even have a line at this point. Glenn simply makes the decision. Maggie and I will come with you if you wait.
Has Maggie actually spoken about Beth this season?
There was one scene at the very end of the first episode where Daryl tells her that Beth's still alive.
That's the main plot hole there. Maggie just seems to go along with Glenn's decision immediately, even though she has learned through Daryl in, I think it was the last episode, that Beth is definitely out there somewhere. She was led off in a car, and she also knows that Daryl and Carol have just driven off in a car. And even though they don't know that it's to find Beth, one might be able to put two and two together.
Because they don't expect that people, especially Daryl, who is extremely loyal to Rick, are just going to take off for no good reason. No, and I think that is a bit of a gap. That's probably the biggest gap in the episode.
Well, actually, I'm going to go out there and say it. There's another huge gap in the episode, actually. And I've just thought of this.
I'm going to write a letter to the editor.
Right. Abraham says, "We need to get Eugene out of here right now." Okay. What's Abraham's reason for wanting to leave right there and then?
Protecting Eugene.
From the cannibals.
Yes.
Now, when Eugene and Abraham actually leave later in the show, the cannibals have all been slaughtered. There's no immediate threat. It's 12 a.m. on a nice sunny afternoon. They still haven't solved the problem of Daryl and Carol. Why leave right then?
We could say it is a plot hole, very, very much so. But at the same time, it could just simply be Abraham's character. He said he's staying for 12 more hours to help, and then he's leaving. 12 hours have passed, he's leaving.
Yeah.
Even though the situation has now been resolved, he still has that end goal of DC.
He's wanted to go all along. But it strikes me as weird that Glenn and Maggie wouldn't then say, "Oh, hold on, look, I know we agreed to this, but we've kind of solved this problem. Can I at least hang out and see what happened to Daryl and Carol?"
I agree. That would make sense to you and I, but we're reasoning, non-apocalyptic living human beings who would look at it from all angles. He's still thinking, if I stick around for another day or two, something bad might happen, right? And so I need to get, it's always going to be some new excuse. We need to stay for this. We need to stay for that. So, yeah, I agree that it could be seen as a plot hole. I think it's also just a character part. I think it's part of who he is.
I suppose I'm being pretty churlish. I can't complain. I won't complain about this episode.
You're just so picky. Okay, so basically once Glenn and Maggie Glenn, on behalf of Maggie and himself, have told Abraham that they're going to go with him, Abraham agrees to stay for 12 hours. He says, "I'll stay for 12 hours, and after that, we're out of here."
Right.
Which strategically actually makes sense, because it'll be daylight, it'll be much safer, etc., etc. So he's not really giving up a hell of a lot. But then, of course, Rick lays out his plan, or so we think, because we don't hear it. This is one of those moments where they decide, we're not going to show you the planning session so that we can surprise you later. And I think it's very effective. It works really well here.
Yeah, you need it. A bit of tension. And they throw in a little clue that there might be a curveball by saying they're not going to be expecting us to be thinking straight. And then I think Rosita says, "Are we thinking straight?" or something like that.
And then we get one of the coolest shots in the episode, which is a night scene looking out from the church. You see the church's placard. And on the right-hand side, you see a moonlit road. On the left-hand side, you see the forest and the cemetery. And we see Rick and the group come out of the church, right? Now, before they get to that shot, actually, we do see an interesting thing. As they come out of the church, on the side of the wall, we see a big red A painted. And that's reminiscent, of course, of Terminus.
Right, the lettering that was painted on the containers, the fresh meat.
So basically, this is another psychological game by Gareth and co. They're saying, you guys are just basically in another boxcar, and we're going to be culling you as we need you. So they start walking off, and they're on the left-hand side of the shot. The placard of the church kind of divides the picture into two. We see them quietly in the dark, going into the woods and disappearing. And then we get something you very rarely see in a limited time television program, and that's about 10 seconds of absolutely no movement and no sound, which is very effective because it builds the tension without having to really say, hey, we're building the tension here. And then we see what? On the right side, figures.
Gareth and his cronies skulking back along the road. That whole scene was really effective. I'm looking over at my notes now. There was only about 5 or 6 scenes in this whole episode, which is probably half the average. There were a lot of slow shots. The use of music was excellent, actually. The guy does the score, Bear McCreary. He also does the music for Constantine and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well. I don't watch that one.
Two of the shows that I do review on my blog, actually, yeah.
But yeah, his score was really good in this episode. Particularly, that part was silent when the two groups were kind of walking past one another in the night. But later on, particularly in those tense moments in the church when there's a confrontation, the score was excellent. It was really cinematic for one of the first times in this show. I mean, it feels like it is a soap opera set in the post-apocalypse, but it really had some cinematic characteristics.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking about the school, before we move on too much further, there was a scene that was a really interesting image as well that was earlier when Bob was still at the school. And that was Gareth talking about the windows of the school and how they're going to break eventually.
Yeah.
And there's this image of him superimposed or in front of the window, which has a whole bunch of walkers pressing up against it with their faces. And this, to me, was a way of kind of tying Gareth a little bit to the governor with the whole aquarium that the governor used to have.
Yeah, definitely, like we discussed.
But there was a double meaning there, too, because what do the zombies eat? Human flesh. What does Gareth eat? Human flesh. There's an equation between the two of them at that moment as well.
There was a lot of foreshadowing there, and a kind of some false foreshadowing too. It was obviously all metaphorical. The glass was about to break. You get the sense things are coming to a head. Something's going to happen. But you also got the idea that there was they were trying to mislead you technically. The idea that they might be leading Rick and the gang back into this trap where these zombies might come out. You feel like the school setting was going to be significant later in a way that it wasn't. So that works again in the context of the ambiguity of Rick's plan when he hasn't really explained what they're doing. Like at that point, I was thinking, well, they're probably going to get to the school and we're going to see something happen there.
Well, they did try to build that expectation as well, because after we see Gareth and the crew coming out of the woods, it cuts to a scene of the school and we see the fire burnt. It's kind of banked low and we see the glass cracking.
Yeah.
And so that shows you very clearly, oh, well, this is where Rick is going and this is what he's going to find, when in fact it was completely the opposite. They never do go to the school. Interesting scene when they were in the church. They come up to the church. They break in. All the candles are out. It's totally dark in the church. To me, I'm looking at that as Gareth. I would see that as a bad sign. Okay, that they're prepared for him and his crew to be there, right? So they go in, and an interesting thing happens. Well, we do know that several people are left behind. Who all's left? There's Eugene, Rosita, Carl, Judith, Tyrese, and Father Gabriel, and Bob, of course. So there's those seven in there. As they're looking at their very tense faces, the camera pans by Eugene at one point, and behind him there's this little framed saying. I've got it written down here. Stupidity is also a gift of God, but one mustn't misuse it.
How do you misuse stupidity? Surely a misuse of stupidity would be intelligence.
Perhaps to become intelligent is to misuse God's gift. The stupidity comment to me, as soon as I saw that, I thought, okay, good. Rick and the gang are coming back. Because Gareth is far too cocksure in this moment.
He is. And actually, Gareth says the word stupid earlier on in the show. He says, when he talked about the school, he says, we marked our way so we can find our way back here. So stupid.
Exactly.
Back to what?
Yeah, they're not going back to Terminus. They're now mobile. They're basically on the road. So there is no home to go back to. But it does explain the notches that we saw. He also talks a little bit about how Terminus ran when he mentions that it wasn't going to be just an automatic, you're going to be eaten, you were going to be given a choice, join us or be food.
It didn't look like they were getting much of a choice when they're in that room with the baseball bats.
No. No, at that point, I think Gareth, the bureaucrat, was upset that Rick and company had kind of messed with his plan. So, back to where we are. Gareth and co, they go up to the front door. As we mentioned earlier, they quite easily break into it. That's Martin who goes up and opens the door. We do notice, by the way, it was kind of interesting, because last week when we saw Martin around the fire, we didn't really notice any kind of result from Tyrese's beating.
But he's got a shiner tonight.
Yeah, his left eye is all swollen shut, basically. So it could be that it's happened so recently that the shiner hadn't fully swollen up as of the episode last week.
Yeah, well, we could have just missed it last week, but I really don't remember seeing it.
Yeah, I don't either. I'd have to look back. They come in, and they get up to the apse, and there are two doors. And Gareth's completely bold. He's talking the whole time. They come in quietly. Now, there is a foreshadowing again. He walks, and they do a close-up on his feet on the floor. And you note, what's the first thing you see when... What's the first thing you think when you're watching a tense moment of silence and they focus on somebody's foot about to come down on a wooden floor?
Like a creak.
You're expecting a creak. And what happens? There is no sound. So this actually is foreshadowing how quietly Rick and the group can come in behind them. This allows us to believe that they can come in undetected. I mean, they don't close the door behind them. They don't bolt it. Gareth doesn't care. He knows that there's 10 minutes either way to the schoolyard, so he's got at least 20 minutes to deal with the people inside the church before Rick returns.
Yeah. Rick's plan, a good a plan as it was, it kind of relied upon the door being left open.
That's true. So as you pointed out earlier, he may just not have latched it properly. He may have left it so that it was easy for Martin to get in. So they know that they're in one of two rooms at the end of the church. The church is fairly small. And there's the door on the left, and there's the door on the right. And he's talking, he's trying to convince Father Gabriel to give everyone up, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good bet.
Yeah, well, he knows he's a coward. He even offers to allow him to keep Judith, which is kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, he says you can take the baby and walk out of here. But then his next line comes after Judith kind of gives the game away.
She cries, as babies do.
He says, well, I might keep this kid. I'm starting to like her.
And that's one of the things I do like about Gareth's character. He is charming. He is witty. He's intelligent, but maybe he thinks he's more intelligent than he actually is. Mm-hmm. That's as Andrew J. West was playing him. Very handsome young guy, very charismatic. He played it well, but he's far too sure of himself. He thinks that he's got Rick outsmarted. So they figure out what room they're in, and they give him another chance to come out, but nobody says anything. They're absolutely silent. And so Martin gets pissed off a little bit, right? So Gareth tells him to shoot out the two hinges.
And right when he gives that command,
thwip, thwip.
Two of the guys get dropped.
Yeah, the two that are either side of the door, silenced bullets hit them directly in the head. They both collapse. And much to Gareth's credit, he handles this super well. He thinks he's still in control of the situation. He doesn't panic. He doesn't drop. But he says, basically, yeah, you put your guns down because we're going to shoot right through the store and kill everybody.
To which Rick just, well, I presume it's Rick, just blows two of his fingers off.
Yes, yes, it's a great shot. Blood splatter everywhere, the two fingers are gone, and Gareth's all of a sudden not quite so sure of himself.
No, he's not. Yeah, that scene was good. It was just like at the end of Taxi Driver when Travis Bickle blows the fingers off that guy with that huge 44 Magnum.
Yeah, you got to have a little bit of blood spray, right? I mean, it's a bullet of that caliber hits something that small, it just shatters and turns into mist. And it's very well done. Gareth grabs his hand and basically, yep, I'm going to go down on my knees now. Rick's like, drop your weapons and get down on your knees. Martin refuses to at first.
Yeah, they said, we don't have a choice. And he's like, yeah, we do. And Abraham moves in swiftly from the flank.
No, you don't. And he's got his automatic weapon pointed right at Martin. Martin finally caves and goes down. Then a really interesting conversation occurs between Gareth and Rick, where we've got the reversal, right? The reversal. You had the image in the opening episode where Rick is on his knees at the trough. Here he is. He's on his knees. And very symbolically, he's on his knees at the altar here in the church. Mm-hmm. He's right at the front of the church. He's like a supplicant. And he does try to supplicate, as it were. He asks Rick. He opens by saying, there's no chance for me here, is there, basically. And Rick doesn't disagree with him. But then he starts to try to bargain.
Yeah, so Gareth starts trying to talk his way out of it. He goes back into the Terminus backstory a little bit. He says, oh, people were really mean to us. That's why we are the way we are.
We did good.
You know, we were going to, you know, we probably might not have killed you. And then he says, well, just let us go.
I promise you, we
won't do anything bad ever again.
Yeah, well, he doesn't promise never to do anything bad. He promises he'll never cross paths with Rick again.
Yeah.
And Rick's kind of like, well, you know, but you're going to do this exact same thing to everybody else.
Yeah, no matter who you find.
He does ask Rick, he points out to Rick the very good point that you didn't shoot us when you could have. You walked in and you could have just shot us, but you didn't. So this to Gareth is an opening. This says to Gareth, hey, he doesn't want to kill us. Maybe I can negotiate with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But what does Rick say?
We didn't want to waste the bullets.
beautiful moment. Yeah. And one that a lot of other zombie shows could learn from. Bullets are a finite commodity in this world. So he didn't want to waste the bullets. And then Gareth's eyes drop down to Rick's waistband. On the left-hand side, he has something in a sheath.
Yeah, the red handle of the machete that he promised he would use on Gareth back in the abattoir.
And he says to Gareth, in fact, he says, "Besides, I already made you a promise." And he takes it, and that's, wow. And then this scene, just this intense, intense scene of violence.
And then the bloodbath happens.
Like... It does. Abraham with the butt end of his gun over and over again. He actually kills the woman, I believe.
I think it's Michonne.
Michonne kills the woman, okay, and then Abraham takes out one of the other guys. Yeah. Sasha goes absolutely to town on Martin.
Sasha's the best, because she's like kneeled over him. His head's lolling back, and she's just stabbing him in the throat.
And it reminded me a lot of the scene with Rick in episode 416A, when he takes out the man who was trying to rape his son.
Yeah, it was really feral.
Oh, just absolutely covered in blood and gore. And you understand, as much as it seems, like if somebody just walked into this show and saw that scene, they think, what is this gratuitous garbage? Mm-hmm. They're just overdoing it for shock value. But if you see the build-up, these people have eaten Bob Stookey's leg, they've threatened to kill all of you and eat all of you. They had been eating people for some time.
Yeah, they threatened Rick's kids.
And they don't even deserve like an easy, painless execution. They deserve to go down hard, and they went down hard.
Yeah. Did you fully expect that to happen? I mean, I had a pretty good feeling. As soon as you saw the machete handle, I knew that Gareth was done for. But did you expect them just to massacre them all like that?
Well, okay, again, this is going to be a bit of a spoiler from the comics, so the next minute or so I'll be talking about that. I've read the comics, as you know, and you've recently started looking at some of them, but there was this extremely bloody response to the cannibals in the comics, very much like how it played out in the show. I did not expect them to go there simply because of the different aesthetic with television as opposed to a comic book where you can kind of draw gore, mm-hmm. but when you're having to show the blood splatter all over their faces and all over the apse of the church, I think it's a lot more visceral. I think it's a lot more gutsy to make that choice. Interestingly, there was a comment in Talking Dead after the show that stated that the reason they did, one of the major reasons they built the church from scratch was simply because of that scene. They didn't think anybody or any church would agree to allow that kind of a scene to be filmed in it. So that's one of the reasons why they created a church from scratch. They built it up. It's a cathartic moment. Now, the audience has been watching this. If you're at all sympathetic to Bob, if you're sympathetic to anybody who's been cannibalized, then you need catharsis, as Aristotle told us in his Poetics. And here's a moment of catharsis. Here's a moment where we get the bloodlust satisfied, where we see somebody, very much again like what Rick did to that man who tried to rape Carl. You need to have some modicum of satisfaction to show that there is justice.
Yeah. There's some uneasy looks on a few of our friends.
Well, even Maggie and Glenn, who are looking at it, but aren't disapproving, but they're stunned, right?
Yeah, Maggie and Glenn, they seem to accept that this has got to happen. They just, maybe they don't like the aesthetics of it. Father Gabriel's a little bit upset.
Very upset,
He wanders in saying, "This is the Lord's house."
And Maggie responds to that and says, "No, it's four walls and a roof," which is the title of the episode, so that's where we get that from.
Right, and Tyrese is pretty disapproving, right?
Well, I don't know that I saw...
He's already, earlier in this episode, he's already asked Sasha to consider forgiving the people who have eaten her boyfriend's leg.
Which just blows me away, because, I mean, as much as he's a bit of a peacenik right now, that's, I think, asking too much of a person.
Yeah.
I think we could be misreading that, too. I don't know if he's asking her to forgive the termites or the termians so much as he's asking her to forgive herself for her rage.
Oh, you think?
In a sense. I think it's an internalized thing, because he tells her... That, like he says, you know, I went through this. I know how it feels. And so she says, then you understand. And he says, yes, but then you don't get these moments back. And so I think his own internal forgiveness is for not mourning over Karen at the time that he should have, mm-hmm. or for not going in when she was sick and trying to care for her. He realizes he should have done those things, which he didn't. And Sasha has the opportunity to spend those last moments with Bob, which, as it turns out, she's able to. But he wants her to realize that there are choices you make that you don't come back from again.
Right, yeah. So you get Sasha finishing a job for Tyrese, but later on we get Tyrese helping Sasha out in a similar fashion. So we should probably start talking about the immediate aftermath of this bloodbath. Everyone's been killed, but we still have Bob. And I think the next scene is the following morning, and you get the whole group filtering into Gabriel's back room where Bob is lying out on the sofa.
This is where Maggie has the most inappropriate line of the night, where she says, "You'll always be with us, part of us. I'm sorry, but the whole episode was about dealing with cannibals.
Yeah.
And you've got her telling him, you'll be part of us.
Yeah.
Well, he'll be part of Gareth for sure, you know, forever. But, well, his moldering remains. But it was kind of a funny little moment that got my attention.
Especially as Bob is lying there under a wooden carving of the Last Supper.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's no symbolism in that whatsoever. So there's that. And then he has the conversation with Rick. Rick brings Judith, and he looks at Judith, Bob does, and he says, like, looking at her, can't you see the hope for the future? Like, and as we all know, all of us who do critical theory or read or, you know, study literature or other things, babies are almost always a symbol of hope and innocence in the future. So Judith is this obvious symbol that's sitting on Rick's lap.
Right, yeah. It's exactly the same in The Road. Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which is in many ways far bleaker even than The Walking Dead.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But the point of the boy, I mean, the whole book and the movie revolve around these two characters, the man and the boy. But something they continually talk about, the reason that they're going on, is that they have to carry the light inside.
Carry the fire.
Yeah, carry the fire, sorry. Yeah. And the fire, I mean, it variously is used as a metaphor just for hope or a metaphor for morality.
Humanity.
But the same kind of things seem to be happening in The Walking Dead. There's a couple of characters, Bob towards the end of his life, and Tyrese consistently, and even Glenn, who are saying, you know, our job is to carry something, you know, maintain some sort of connection with humanity.
Well, speaking to that bleakness in The Road, an interesting aside is that the only time you actually see a baby in The Road is when it's been barbecued for food.
Yeah.
So there's that sense of complete loss of hope and innocence.
Yeah, there's no sentimentality in that show.
No, none whatsoever. Maybe we'll do a review of that movie at some point in the future, because
I think it might be a good idea, actually. Put it into the season, because I've got a feeling there's going to be a lot of different resonances.
Yeah, there's a lot of post-apocalyptic out there for people who are fans of the show and want more of this kind of theme and story. And we can probably cover some of that.
Why don't we do a rundown of our top 10 apocalyptic movies and TV shows?
That sounds great. We'll do a show on that sometime in the near future and talk about their pros and cons and where you can find them. So there's a show for the future to look forward to. So we've got the aftermath are talking. And what is it? There's a really good line Bob has here.
Yeah, because Bob's talking to Rick, and he's trying to convince Rick that even though things look grim, it's worth continuing. And he says, remember what I said yesterday? I ain't revising it. Even in light of current events, nightmares end. They shouldn't end what you are. And that's just one dead man's opinion.
Yeah, and it puts beautifully into words exactly what the theme of the first three episodes has been. Because we've had this contrast between Gareth's group and Rick's group. And they've both been through hell. They've both dealt with horrible people. They both had their governors, right? And Gareth's group chose to go one direction. Now, if it were Rick and the gang, and some group had infiltrated the prison and they'd managed to kill them off, I don't see Rick and the group turning to cannibalism.
No.
That's not who they are. They would have maintained themselves despite the nightmare. And Bob is saying he's saying you're doing the right thing. And secondly, he's saying, don't forget that you're doing the right thing. Don't let this horrible world change you.
And most of these monologues have been directed at Rick. And Rick's an interesting figure in this season, because his appearance is becoming increasingly disheveled. He has this big grey beard. Do you remember in the first season, he was kind of like a clean-cut, good-looking, all-American guy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's become grizzled, but not in the kind of way that Daryl has, still remaining kind of attractive.
He's turning into Grizzly Adams.
Looking, but Rick is now looking pretty grim.
I'm just waiting for him to take on a pet bear named Ben at some point.
Yeah, his hair's long, lank, and greasy. He's sort of starting to look a bit like Herschel when he grew his beard, right? But Rick's also, I don't know if you've noticed this, but he's also changed in terms of his mannerisms, his body language. He started moving in this weird, creepy animal way. Like when he's staring down Gabriel, he starts sort of crouching, almost like he's coiling to lunge at him, like he's moving like a puma or some kind of cat. And he has these weird twitches and jerks, and he's always looking at people out of the corner of his eyes, kind of not directly. And it seems to me that there's a conscious effort to animalize him, to make him seem more feral.
This is a very interesting point you bring up. And Andrew J. West, who played Gareth, last night he was on Talking Dead. And he actually brought up the fact that, like, Lincoln. Andrew Lincoln.
Yeah.
Is one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. Super sweet guy. But he says that when you're acting opposite him and he's getting ready for the scene, he goes through all these physical transformations. He does all these vocalizations. He's animalizing himself.
Yeah.
He actually says this on the show.
Oh, he does?
And you're picking up on that because he's been doing this to try to get into character. I also noticed when he was dealing with Gareth later in the episode, that as solid as he is, as dead-eye as he is looking into Gareth, there's still like a little hint of twitchiness about his face.
Yeah.
Because he knows he's going to have to go somewhere where he's not comfortable going, but he has to go there.
Right.
And so I think, frankly, I think Andrew Lincoln has become a better actor over the last 5 years.
He definitely has. And he has fewer lines now. And the lines that he does deliver are delivered in this kind of guttural voice. Not completely unlike Christian Bale's Batman voice.
Oh, yeah, except a little bit more audible.
A little bit more audible, and not quite as ridiculous. It sort of works for him. I don't think, Rick isn't American. He's got a British accent, right?
That's true, Andrew Lincoln
is British. And although his accent is damn good, when he has a lot of lines, he sort of compensates by hamming up the southern twang. And sometimes it can come across as a little bit corny, but this season, he's had fewer lines, and he's delivered them much better with this new persona, these new bodily tics. I think his acting has really improved.
I agree, and he's also stopped doing that weird thing where he used to, whenever he was talking to somebody, especially about something uncomfortable, usually it was Shane, but sometimes other people, he'd do this thing where he kind of hunched his shoulders and moved his head a little bit down to the right, and was kind of trying to give that physical, like, I'm listening to you, I'm paying attention to you, can we find a middle ground here? He doesn't give a hoot about the middle ground anymore. He's much more aggressive in his body language. He does hunch, but he's not hunching like away. He's hunching towards.
And that was difficult, especially when you're acting opposite a master body actor like the guy who portrayed Shane, who would just rub his head and look confused.
The head rubber. Hey, I've heard he's really good in that new Brad Pitt film. The one, what's that? Is it Fury? The one with the tank?
It's funny you should mention Brad Pitt, because I thought that Shane's performances, I don't know the actor's name, but I thought that his performances were reminiscent of, you remember that scene at the end of Seven,
yeah,
when Brad Pitt finds the contents of the box?
Oh,
and
yeah,
he undergoes
don't
like
open a, it don't yeah
10
yeah.
to 15 seconds of anguish when he's deciding what to do before,
yes,
he ultimately shoots Kevin Spacey in the face. But during those 10 seconds of agitation, he is just Shane. He's rubbing his head, his eyes are flicking from left to right, like Shane existed in that moment.
Oh, absolutely. And his name's John Bernthal, just to
John Bernthal,
you know.
Right, yeah, credit where credit's due.
And Fury is the movie that is out right now with him in it.
Yeah.
And apparently he's getting good reviews on that, but so is Shia LaBeouf or whatever you want to call him. I just call him asshole most of the time, but sorry, I have a personal opinion towards people that plagiarize other filmmakers and writers all the time and then try to get away with it by plagiarizing apologies and things like that. The guy's a jerk. Anyhow, sorry, Shia, I have this a personal opinion. It's not, you know.
You're not sorry, Steve. Get on with it.
Okay, I'm not sorry. I don't like the guy. I liked a couple of his movies. Okay, so yeah, you've got this wonderful moment that encapsulates the theming of the last several episodes. And then we finish up Bob's part with Sasha basically sitting vigil with him. And he's been sleeping. He's been out of it. As she says, you're out of it, she says to him when he comes to. He comes to laughing and smiling, which is a wonderful thing, because Bob has been Mr. Optimus lately, right?
Yeah.
And they talk a little bit, and he tells her he was having a dream. And in that dream, she was smiling at him too, which makes her smile. And he says, that's it. And you see, he's very weak. He's definitely going soon. And she looks at him and she says, she doesn't want to deal with his death. She's very upset about it, but she's handling it like a trooper. And she says, so what is it? The good that comes out of this bad. And she looks at him for an answer, but he just, and then that's it.
Yeah, man. Like,
yeah.
It feels like a good death is kind of what Bob wanted all along.
And he has it in that moment, I think. And this is there's a beautiful, touching moment here that happens then between the siblings, between Sasha and Tyrese, because Tyrese has been unable to finish what he's started or what he's had to do. He's been unable even to put down walkers so far this season, even since the Just Look at the Flowers episode. He hasn't been able to kill. But he comes in and he just puts his hand out and asks for the knife. This reminds me a lot of last season. Do you remember when Herschel had a hard time putting down the walkers?
Yeah.
And Glenn was offering to do it for him, but Herschel basically said, no, I've got to be able to do this myself. And he does. He succeeds. He finds that strength within himself. The same thing happens here with Tyrese. And I got to be honest, it was this very touching, almost the gentlest insertion of a knife into a person's cranium that I've ever seen. And gentle is not a term I would normally use for somebody sticking a knife into a guy's temple.
No, despite the crunchy, squelchy sound effect.
That was a great sound effect, yeah. That, you know, you can't even do that properly, but it wasn't disturbing at all. You know, the funny thing is, normally when you see somebody putting, and I see this often, somebody putting a knife into somebody's temple, it's something you see a lot in Port Moody. It's
daily. Yeah.
You know, all the time. It disturbs you somewhat. You know, it might kind of ruin your day, give you, you know, a bit of an upset stomach. But here I just saw that and I thought, no, that was so delicately done, so well done. And it's a moment for Tyrese where he comes back a little bit. There's actually a bit of a redemption for him in this because he does what he needs to do for his sister that wasn't done for his girlfriend. And it shows that he's going to be able to move forward, I think.
Yeah, and it emphasizes the co-reliance that he and Sasha have. I mean, Sasha had Bob. Bob's gone now.
The next time we see Sasha, she's outside. She's tying two sticks together over top of Bob's grave. So she's creating a cross for him.
It's quite a flimsy-looking cross.
It is, but I think that there is really no substance left in this world. There's no permanency left in this world, and she recognizes that. So, okay, so we've got Sasha. She's tying the cross for Bob, and Abraham is getting ready to leave. He brings the bus around, I think, and he's got everybody on board. Maggie and Glenn say their goodbyes. They've got their bags. They head into the bus and stick their heads out the window, and before they leave, Abraham hands a map to Rick and says, "This is going to be our route. Try and follow us when you can." I'll mention what Abraham wrote on the map, and there's going to be a little bit of swearing here just for our younger audience members, so plug your ears. But he's written on the map, "Sorry I was an asshole. Come to DC. The new world is going to need Rick Grimes." So that's kind of cool. He's basically, that's his way of saying, you know, sorry. He does say sorry, I was an asshole, but he can't say it verbally. He has to write it down for Rick. And in a place where Rick will see it after he's left, because he's a bit of a proud man.
Yeah, I tried to freeze frame that map, actually, to see where they were. I couldn't quite make it out, but I think they're still in Georgia.
Well, they're west of Atlanta. Yeah, Atlanta is pretty central to the state. They're over towards Opelika, Alabama. Mm-hmm. They're close to the Alabama border. If you look at the way Rick looked at the map, they're going to be trending northeast and then basically just going straight north up to D.C. But then Rick looked down and towards Atlanta as kind of a, I don't think he was particularly planning on going to Atlanta, but there's certainly a subtext there that we might be going to Atlanta. Atlanta, we haven't seen the last of it, and we do get a hint that we're going to be in Atlanta next week when we see the season. Sorry, when we see the preview for next week, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. Before that, the bus leaves. Rick is watching Tyrese, and Tyrese is digging a grave.
Yeah, digging a grave for everyone, I think.
Yeah, there's a whole pile of stuff covered in a bloody tarp or a bloody sheet. We're assuming it's obviously the hunters.
Yeah. Well, in last episode, after they got out of Terminus, Rick said, let them turn. He had complete disregard for the dead at that point. But it seems now, having killed them, having killed Gareth, there's some sort of sense of closure.
Well, there's maybe a return to humanity a little bit, or else there's simply a respect between Rick and Tyrese, and Rick looks at what Tyrese is doing and says, yeah, I'll support him in this. And so he asks Tyrese, he says, we haven't really talked much. How was getting to Terminus for you?
Did he say, it killed me?
It killed me, is what he said. Yeah, he pauses, he kind of looks over, he says, it killed me.
And Rick says,
no, it didn't.
No, it didn't.
Yeah, no, it didn't. No, it didn't. Maybe he did die on the road in some sense. The Tyrese that was alive before, the Tyrese that was violent, that could pummel Rick into the ground for what happened to Karen, the Tyrese that could take his hammer to dozens and dozens of walkers, as he did when he got out of the car when they were going to the veterinarian hospital and places like that. He died, in a sense, because of what happened with he and Carol and the two girls, Micah and Lizzie, on the road. But now perhaps he's been reborn. And we got this whole imagery of the church. You had most of the group being baptized by blood at the apse, in a sense. They were bathing in the blood of Gareth, whether they wanted to or not. And you've got Tyrese, who is watching the whole thing, and now he's doing something else. He's able to take out Bob. He's digging this grave. He's showing two sides to himself. He can do what he needs to do to survive, but he can also be human at the same time. Is he going to be the next wise man in the show? Because we had Dale, we had Herschel, we've kind of almost had Glenn a little bit. Is it going to be Tyrese now that Glenn's moved on?
Tyrese seems to be a good moderator. Glenn always felt like he was a mod in a flame war, you know, just stepping in, trying to set everyone back down again. that's been his job for a while now. Obviously, the baton's passed on to Tyrese now. I mean, who do we have left in the group? It's kind of an interesting collection. We can only presume that Carol pulls through, but maybe not. We have Daryl, Michonne, Rick, the kids, Gabriel, and Tyrese and Sasha. So we don't have too many level-headed people there. You've got Michonne's kind of nihilistic. She just does what she needs to do. Rick is no longer... Rick's a pure pragmatist now. Mm-hmm. He's gone kind of feral. He and Michonne are kind of similar characters in a way now. They're a little bit jaded by everything.
Michonne's something of a cipher at times. I really don't know what her motivations are. I love Michonne's character. I love the idea of Michonne.
Mm.
And I did love, as we said earlier, the character exposition that we got about her last year, learning a lot about her background. But there are still times when you don't know what her motivations are. Sometimes her motivation simply seems to be, this is what the group's doing, okay, I'll support that.
Yeah, Michonne doesn't have a motivation. Everyone else seems to have a task. I mean, Rick's obviously kind of a steward. Daryl sees his job very much as the tracker, the hunter, the provider. That he's subservient, but he likes it. He likes his role. But with Michonne, she's like an insider-outsider. She's with the group. There were some efforts made to establish a connection with Carl and certainly Andrew in the past. But otherwise, yeah, she doesn't tend to make too many decisions. In the comic books, and this isn't really a spoiler, she's a much more alert, kind of conniving, strong-minded character.
Although very much a lieutenant.
Yeah, very much a lieutenant. But she has a lot of ideas, and she's very shrewd, and she's often pointing things out.
Yeah, she in does the call TV Rick on his bullshit sometimes, that's true.
In the TV show, she just seems sort of depressed. You know, she's not too cheerful when things are going well, and she's not too cheerful or too upset when things are going badly. She just gets on with it.
I think she still lacks a clear motivation, and hopefully, I mean, she is, interestingly, the one who finds our returnee at the very end of the episode, and shows some genuine emotion when she sees him, when Daryl comes out of the bushes.
But, yeah, we should talk about that part.
Yeah, so that's the stinger at the very end. We've got Michonne sitting on the stairwell, outside the church. And then is it Father Gabriel comes and talks to her?
Yeah, Father Gabriel comes out. He wants to talk again about how horrible it was that he let everyone go out and die. No, he's saying that he can still remember the screams and stuff. And Michonne's sort of comforting him. She says something like, it's all right.
They never go away. Better.
Don't worry about it.
But you don't hear them every day.
I've seen worse stuff, man.
Yeah, she has. If he could see her with her two zombie pets, maybe he would step back a little bit and go, okay, yeah, things could be worse than this, that's for sure.
Like, oh, Gabriel, you're so cute.
So then they hear a rustling in the bushes, but it's nighttime, it's dark. Gabriel's already gone back into the church. He kind of slinks back in, as you mentioned
earlier. Yeah, as soon as he hears the rustling in the bushes, he immediately needs the bathroom.
She pulls out her sword, her now returned sword. She's very happy about this. It was on one of the cannibals that he was carrying in his backpack, so she had taken that. And it was funny because last episode, she told Rick that she didn't really miss it. What she missed were, you know, them, the people.
Mm-hmm.
But here she pulls out the sword, and she obviously is very happy to have it back.
Oh, yeah, and we get that low-angle camera shot of her just pulling it out and standing there silhouetted.
You know, almost reverential. Reverential in a treatment.
She's drawing the sword out of the gore on the floor and just holding it there with this sort of sense of inevitability.
It takes me back to the first time we saw Michonne, which was Andrea was being attacked by a walker, and she was down on her back and crawling backwards, and all of a sudden there's this whoosh as this sword comes through and takes off the head, and then she flicked it, you know, to get the blood off.
Well, I was watching the show on AMC, and they actually interspersed that shot in the commercials.
Oh, yeah, they brought that back.
Yeah, they stuck a few bits in. It's kind of annoying.
They're talking about not all new episodes. They're talking about replaying old episodes because it's coming up to Halloween and all that. So that scene was reshown. That's probably why I just suddenly thought of it. I probably saw
that. That's sort of annoying, actually, because when I was rewatching it this morning, I was trying to flick through it. And so you're forwarding, and then you see scenes of The Walking Dead, so you stop, and then you realize it's just an old one.
This is true.
I'm pretty sure it is just a technique to get you to stop and then accidentally watch the commercial that follows it.
Those bastards.
So, Michonne wanders out and hears this rustling in the bushes.
And I have a little bit of a problem with this because Daryl, the tracker, last episode, there's like twice where they hear him and he shows up. Here again, she hears something and it's Daryl. Which should have actually... Maybe it's not even a problem. Maybe this was foreshadowing. You see, I think there's a lot of stuff that works together in this show that comes out later. And maybe they were like, okay, he makes a little bit of noise in the bush. So when you hear the noise in the bush, is it Daryl?
Yes. Is it Daryl?
It's Daryl. But he's got something he's hiding. Uh-huh. And we don't know what it is.
No, there's a look in his face. When he first pops out of the bushes, he's smiling, but in a strange kind of way. And then Michonne's face freezes. And she says, where's Carol?
And so he turns around and he says, come on out.
So we've no idea.
And we have a smash cut to black. Bang. Right
there. No idea what's there. Who's there?
No, we got three possibilities, right?
I guess so.
If it's a solitary person, it's got to be one of three people. It's got to be Carol. But then why would he hide her? It could be Beth. but then why would he hide her?
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be Morgan, whom we saw at the end of the opening episode of the season. But then again,
I am thought of Morgan.
Well, it could be Morgan possibly because he's following Spore. He's coming towards them. But the problem with Morgan is that Daryl's never met him. He wouldn't know who the hell Morgan is. He would just be some guy whom he would not trust to bring to the group, you would think.
Yeah.
Unless something's happened where Morgan has helped him and they've formed some sort of a bond and he's being cautious about bringing him forward. Because the last time we saw Morgan was in episode 303 or 304, which is called Clear.
Yeah.
And he was crazy. He'd lost it. He'd lost his son. He'd lost his wife. He had turned Rick's hometown into a veritable fortress and was completely non-cognizant of what was going on around him. So if Daryl knows who this guy was, or Morgan remembers any of that, they may be cautious about approaching Rick just because of where he was mentally the last time he saw Rick.
Yeah. Or it could be that he just stumbled across Morgan in the bushes and has tied him up.
Except that he told him to come out. Well, then he could have his hands tied, I suppose. That's true. My personal feeling on this is that we're going to find out next week who it is he has in the bush. Possibly over the next 2 weeks, depending
on how... That's a bold prediction, Steve.
He's got one in the bush. Oh, two in the bush, one in the hand. So he's...
So it's definitely a bird.
Yes, it's definitely a bird. I suspect, okay, my own personal theory, and this has nothing to do with the comics, because this is completely new stuff. It's not in the comics at all.
Mm-hmm.
The Hunters, now that they're gone, I think we're, again, departing from the comic books, which is wonderful, because I love to be surprised. We saw a preview for next week, which was at the very end of the episode. They also put a bit of a preview into Talking Dead. We're going to be in Atlanta.
It looks like Atlanta. There's certainly an urban environment.
Exactly. We're focusing on Beth. It looks like she's in a hospital. And there's somebody dressed as a cop that apparently hits her. That's all we know.
Mm-hmm.
So she's being kept, obviously against her will, with an abusive person dressed as a police officer in what appears to be a hospital. She's got an IV in her arm, things like that. We know that Daryl and Carol last week started following the car that looks the same as the car that took Beth. We know that next week we're going to see Beth. So I think you're going to see Daryl and Carol as well. They're going to be, you know, it's going to be them following the car, getting to where Beth is. We're going to see some stuff from Beth's perspective. It may take one episode, it may take two episodes, but I think that we're going to see a resolution there, because Daryl would not be coming back if there was not a resolution of some sort. So my theory is that he and Carol managed to get Beth out, but Carol is either taken, which I hope it is, or hurt or killed. And he's back with Beth, but has to tell the group, yeah, we've lost Carol, or we all have to go to Atlanta to get Carol back.
But if it's going to be Beth that he's back with, then all of the stuff that we're going to learn about Beth is going to have to be told in flashback.
Well, no, that's the thing. Is you remember at the very end of episode 6, no, 5 last season, we see the governor watching the prison.
Yeah.
And then we go into 2 episodes with the governor before he shows back up at the prison.
Right, yeah.
So it's going to be the same exact device as that. You're going to see like Daryl's showing back up. Yeah, we're going to watch an episode completely unrelated to what's happening at the church. Possibly too, because we might go back further into Beth's timeline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we might see an entire episode with just Beth and her dealing with her new situation. And then perhaps the week after, Carol and Daryl show up.
Yeah.
And then we see that, and then we'll see the two storylines come back together. We might even get an episode with Abraham and Co. going north at some point, because now that they've split the group again, they did this last season for the last 8 episodes where they split it up into several storylines, which I think worked really well, because we had, you know, it's like when you're reading an epic fantasy and you've got 10 POV characters and you're just really looking forward to your favorite character's POV again. But you do read the other storylines because they all come together at the end, right?
Yeah, even if some of them you kind of rush through them. And that's one thing that I'm hoping doesn't happen here. When you split the storyline up into 3, you can no longer spend as much time dwelling on the details, because you kind of have to rush through it to get us back to the other storyline so the viewer has a sense of cohesion. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they manage to keep up the quality of the first 3 episodes when they're having to deal with multiple storylines, if that's what they do.
Well, there's a really simple thing they can do. Just have more Tyrion point of view, and then they'll be perfectly perfectly capable of having an excellent show the rest of the year.
Right.
If you could bring Tyrion in somehow as a guest star on The Walking Dead. You
know, how do we know that's not what Daryl's got?
We could have vertically challenged walkers. Wouldn't that be awesome? Peter Dinklage as a walker? Oh my god, that would be so cool.
They haven't mined those depths yet, have they, on The Walking Dead?
They could always go with children as walkers too, and then they'd literally be ankle biters.
Yeah, I keep expecting dogs to start turning and stuff like that, but that hasn't happened yet.
No, they've got lots of opportunities there to kind of expand on that side of the show if they want to kind of spoof things a little bit or have a bit of fun. But that's one of the things that the show actually never really does, is it doesn't pay homage, as you were saying last week, to any of the other kind of zombie flicks out there, which is interesting. It creates its own mythology, it follows its own tropes. It creates its own tropes, which are then being copied by other shows nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
So, excellent episode.
Yeah, really good episode. Like, really enjoying this season.
We watched that first episode 2 weeks ago, and we thought, wow, where are they going to go from here? How can they possibly top this? And I wouldn't say necessarily they've topped it, but they've just maintained a fantastic level.
They've definitely maintained it, and they've shown a lot of skill now, because they had the Bloodbath premiere. The last episode was a Bloodbath too, but with lots of really, really good zombie effects. This one, right up until the end, where there was only really one moment of action, the rest of it was just tension, terse dialogue, nice shots. It went really quick. They've done a really good job with the suspense. I think that whatever team they've got making this season is definitely honed, and I can imagine that there's only going to be good things to come.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. I mean, they played this episode as a good horror flick. And we're going to see, they sometimes have different kind of theming or tones, but this season so far has been a return to horror, which has been wonderful. And yeah, it's been what the show is really supposed to be about, but it's a lot less soap opera. It's a lot more action oriented. But the tension has been just beautiful. It's built up wonderfully. So we're going to see hopefully some more good stuff going forward. Again, I don't know how long this is going to last, but hey, if they can keep this up, I'm going to be very happy with season 5.
Yeah, me too. Well, thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you too, Dan. I'll see you next week.
Yeah,
take
we'll
care.
See you guys next week. We have a Facebook page now. You just go to facebook.group/Steve and Dan, I think it is. Wait, is it that, Steve? Do you know?
It's called the Steve and Dan Podcast, I believe, on Facebook. And as well, it's on iTunes now, so you can look us up there and subscribe, please. Also, of course, you can always check out my written reviews at reviewsbysteve.wordpress.com.
All right, guys. See you next week.
Cheers.